History doesn't usually treat fiscal heroes the way it does war heroes, but in his new book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Bill White celebrates Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and several other U.S. presidents who, for nearly 200 years, kept the federal deficit in check despite the country's involvement in wars and economic downturns. Mr. White looks at how the federal government's policy on borrowing has changed over the past dozen years and recommends measures that it could take to alleviate the current budget crisis and restore balances. He is a former mayor of Houston and currently a senior advisor for the investment firm Lazard. His book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Bill White to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be with you.
Are you saying that describing what went right with U.S. fiscal policy during the country's first 200 years of existence will help us understand what's gone wrong during the last 12 years?
Exactly. You know, there's been a radical departure in the fiscal policy in the last 12 years. Before 2001, we only borrowed for war, severe economic downturns, and the like. And since then, we've borrowed to pay for routine operating expenses. It used to be, Leonard, that conservatives would think that you ought to raise taxes to pay for new programs to constrain the growth of government. And progressives believe you ought to make sure that there was you preserve the future and upward mobility. That's why we supported public education and are concerned about the environment. And we don't want to mortgage. We didn't want to mortgage the future with debt.
Well, so both sides actually were talking about raising taxes to pay for things, maybe different things.
Exactly.
And now that's all changed. When did that change? Did that you say 12 years ago? But weren't we already arguing these things during the Reagan White House?
You know, there was in 1981, there was a tax cut and increase in defense and spending. But if you go back to the actual history of what occurred then, everybody assumed that there would be a high level of inflation. And all the charts and economists said that there wouldn't be big deficits because people would be pushed into higher tax brackets naturally because of inflation. So if rates came down, you know, they would be lower than they otherwise would, but tax revenues would still continue to climb.
That was based on the trickle-down theory.
Yeah. And that turned out to be wrong. That is, we brought inflation under control. There was a deficit. But there was a series of acts by people in both parties culminating in the Balanced Budget Act in 1997 between Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich that resulted in a balanced budget. And people in both parties celebrated that fact.
Well, you write that for two centuries, U.S. leaders adhered to an unwritten fiscal constitution, that's what you're calling it, that imposed clear limits on the use of federal debt. Can you describe that unwritten constitution for us? What provisions would it have contained?
Yeah, there were basically, it was pretty straightforward. You could borrow money for extraordinary expenses, and there were four of them that we borrowed for. We borrowed to pay for wars. We borrowed to plug holes during economic downturns. We borrowed to add territory to the nation and extend territory. And finally, we borrowed to prevent states from leaving the union. And that was it. And underneath that, there were pillars that traditions. You had clear accounting, pay-as-you-go budget planning, trust funds set aside to provide for social insurance programs, things like that, that sustained that. What they really did was they curbed the temptation to borrow to pay for routine expenses.
And although the U.S. incurred high levels of debt five times in its history before 2001, wasn't it able to rebalance the federal budget after the crisis was over and then maintain that balance for at least a decade?
Absolutely. I mean, that happened after our first four spikes in debt. And then after World War II, it's interesting. I mean, we'd come out of 16 years of Great Depression, World War II. An incredible amount of money had been borrowed for those purposes, particularly World War II. But then liberals to conservatives, they were fighting like cats and dogs. You know, now I'm not suggesting you're as old as the McCarthy era, but I mean, they
I
were,
am, actually.
You know, Taft and Truman and McCarthy, they were at each other and they were highly partisan, but they agreed on one thing. Debt was high enough so that we ought to balance the budget immediately.
And the tax rates after World War II were very high. We talk now about the United States having the highest tax rate, but tax rates were considerably higher, especially for the wealthy. and we were going through one of the greatest booms in the history of this country, maybe in the world.
Yeah, I mean, people, don't get – you're absolutely right, and don't – let's not forget – people complained like the dickens about the high tax rates back then, but they understood that there wasn't a free lunch. And you remember that from 1945 to 1965 is when the baby boom was born. And the parents of the baby boomers did not want their kids to have this debt load that they would have to service in the future. So they were willing to make the sacrifice.
When was the unwritten fiscal constitution first created? Do we go all the way back to George Washington?
Yeah, George Washington is really the germ of it was a couple of Americans, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Madison was the architect of the Constitution. He had just gotten through passing the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and Jefferson suggested another one, which was some limits on debt. Madison said, it's better to do it based on political principles rather than having firm constitutional language because we may need the flexibility in emergencies.
So was this something that was respected by every political party, Federalist, Democratic, Whig, Republican?
Absolutely. And it was part of the founding tenets of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party that we would preserve national independence and the ability of the next generation to do better by limiting the uses of debt.
Well, what's happened over the last dozen years then? How have both parties been changed their philosophies in this regard?
Imagine just for a moment, picture George W. Bush standing up in front of a State of the Union address in 2001. He hardly received a mandate, you know, because of the result of the popular vote in the election. And then he announced his policy by saying, by quoting Yogi Berra and saying, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. And that's just what he did. He had one spending policy. He continued a growth in spending, modest at the outset. And then he proposed to cut taxes at the same time.
Was that the first time in U.S. history that taxes were cut while the country was at war?
Yes. I mean, we've in the past, during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we cut taxes in every other war, and especially the prolonged wars, but every other major war in the United States history, we raised taxes because, you know, we didn't pay for all the wars with taxes. We paid for most of Korea, by the way, with taxes. We by the end of World War II, we were paying for half of World War II with taxes, but we didn't pay a dime in taxes to pay for these two wars.
Well, and as I remember, I think Paul O'Neill, who had been the Treasury Secretary at the time, was told by Vice President Dick Cheney, you know, Paul, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. We won the midterm elections. This is our due.
And there was something very deep and patriotic in the old days about the idea that if you were going to ask soldiers, men and women, to go sacrifice their lives for the country, you ought to ask civilians to pay part of that price with taxation. And as a matter of fact, even when you borrowed, there were big bond drives in order to encourage people to borrow. People were buying savings bonds and were encouraged to during the Vietnam War.
Well, is the Obama approach all that different from the Bush administration's approach to the national debt? Hasn't Obama proposed tax increases but been unable to get Congress to go along with them?
Yeah, he has. There is a difference, but there is one similarity, and you got to sympathize with the administration and the situation it's in. It took office the year before. Not only there was this great recession, of course, we all know about, and that is a traditional use of borrowed funds, but there had been this lurking problem that people knew about but they didn't address forever, which was how to provide for the Medicare funding for baby boomers. And that's hitting us, you know, right now. I mean, the first baby boomer was eligible for Medicare in 2010. By 2030, the population over 85 would have tripled. There was no reserves created for that. President Clinton had called for reserves to be created for that purpose. That was never done. And now the country faces a real dilemma, and incumbent political leaders are afraid to remind people that we're not paying for Medicare, we're borrowing.
But where would that money come from when the president proposed having a higher tax rate for people who made over $250,000? That was shut down almost immediately. But would that have paid for Medicare, or would that have paid for other things?
No, I mean, as it was, I guess right after the 2012 elections, then they did raise the income tax rate for people over single people over $400,000, single people over 400, married over 450, didn't go all the way down to 250,000 as the president had wanted. But there's different ways you can do it. One of which is just a combination of the Medicare payroll tax. There could be premiums. There could be a portion of the income tax. But whatever way you do it, it hurts everyone. It is not sustainable to borrow money to pay for the Medicare program. That's a problem. Yes, you can say very fairly the Obama administration inherited, but it's a problem that progressives have had a hard time dealing with. Now they're realizing, though, when you look at the budget numbers going forward, we're seeing cuts in all other spending as the cost of medical services is rising and pushing and crowding out everything else.
Well, of course, Obamacare is supposed to deal with that, although we're not sure. The jury's out on that. But there's been a suggestion over the years, always shot down, that perhaps we should raise the Social Security rate, the cost of Social Security for people who earn a certain amount of money. There's a cap on it right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so would that be a way of dealing with it?
Yeah.
You make $1 million, you pay more Social Security than I do?
That's certainly a way that you can immediately restore the solvency of the Social Security system, which is in good shape compared to the rest of the budget. We did raise that ceiling, or we did eliminate the ceiling on the Medicare tax back in the 1990s. It's not going to be easy to solve, but I'll tell you what, for progressive people like me, this issue of balancing the budget shouldn't be just stereotyped as something that Ryan talks about. It's an issue that we all have a stake in if we believe in sustainability of our public programs.
The big issue is how you wind up balancing that budget. My guest is Bill White. He served as Houston's mayor and was twice reelected with an average vote of 88%. Also served as Deputy Secretary of Energy of the United States. He's written a book called America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, which is published by Public Affairs. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Bill White. He's written a book called America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, published by Public Affairs. Did President Bush also finance a major expansion of Medicare in 2003 to cover prescription drugs? And that was almost entirely through borrowing.
Yeah, that was unprecedented that there would be a major new domestic program where there was no source of funding, and it was projected to be finance forever with debt. I mean, and the problem with that, just so folks realize, it's not just a label or old-fashioned. The problem with debt, if you borrow to pay your interest payments, if you did it or your business did it, then interest would start compounding. And compound interest is a curse, just like it can be a blessing for the saver and investor. So that was, how would I say it? He wanted to promise a benefit, but disguise the cost of that benefit without raising taxes to pay for it.
So was the borrowing built into the bill?
Well, it was. That's the problem with the appropriations at the time. It was a spending bill, and in the old days, that if you proposed new spending, you would need to propose taxation. Actually, there was something that was adopted in 1990. In the George H.W. Bush administration in a big battle with Congress. It's called Pay-As-You-Go, and it was employed by the Clinton administration and its allies in Congress. Even Gingrich had jumped on board, but it was dismantled in 2002 so that the Bush administration could ram through these things where they offered benefits without taxes.
But taxes have become toxic. For example, George H.W. Bush said, read my lips, I'm not going to raise taxes. And then when he raised taxes, he paid a price.
He did. But, I mean, he paid a price within the party, but I say history looks back on him a little better. He's I noticed the other day, Leonard, that he's getting this JFK Profiles in Courage Award in May, which I had was honored to receive a few years back for what I did during Katrina. And when you think about it, we need people who, and that's part of the story of the book about physical heroes, who are just willing to tell the truth about what things cost. And you know, American people have a lot of common sense. They don't want to see Medicare cut, and they'll help figure out a way to pay for it.
Isn't fully half of the money the U.S. has borrowed over the past decade being used not to pay for the two wars that we're fighting or to respond to the 2008 recession, but to pay for ordinary routine expenses, including Medicare?
Yeah, and this is in an interview after he was retired from office, one of his first interviews on the economy, George W. Bush, the second President Bush, blamed high borrowing on terrorists and the terrorist attacks. Well, wait a minute. You know, that's letting the terrorists win. If you say that we're going to bankrupt, if we're going to, you know, borrow $1 trillion and encumber our national balance sheet because terrorists attack, that's inviting a terrorist attack practically. Part of it was for the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but another part was for the buildup of the defense budget separate and apart from those wars. The tax cuts, and finally, Medicare.
A number of myths have grown up around the budget process. You say one of them is that the U.S. never balances its budget.
Yeah. I mean, people say, oh, well, they never balance the budget. They never. For most of the country's history, we balance the budget except in the four unique, extraordinary circumstances.
Well, the New Deal was borrowed a lot of money.
Yeah,
borrowed
to plug holes during a severe downturn. I mean, if there's a severe downturn since 1820, we've used it to plug holes in the budget. That's a pretty traditional budget use. The assumption is that during the downturn, you're going to have to borrow some money, and when you come out and recover, that you can pay that down. But few people realize that Franklin Roosevelt vetoed over 600 bills. Most of them spending bills, and he was constantly lecturing people to say, hey, there's certain spending that we're doing now while we're in a downturn, but as soon as we recover, we're going to have to get back to a balanced budget.
You see, another myth is that balancing the budget will hurt the economy.
Yeah, I mean, for most of the nation's history, when we balanced the budget, or even when we had surpluses, we're able to grow the economy. The period that you talked about, this period from 1945 to 1965, would be a prime example where we weren't adding any significant amounts to debt, and yet the economy was growing strongly. And economists, for most of the nation's history, pointed out the fact that if the government has to borrow more, then private businesses wouldn't have that available for their investment.
Is this just a federal situation? You were the Democratic Party's candidate for governor of Texas in 2010, lost to Rick Perry, who has been accused of resorting to tactics like delaying a $2.3 billion payment to schools by one day to technically push it into the next fiscal year and keep it off the books in this year's budget. And then the state legislature was also able to find $800 million by ordering the state's accountants to forecast a faster increase in land values to show more property tax income. So are states doing the same sort of thing that you've been talking about here, or is this even more egregious?
Well, that gets into this whole area I discuss in the book of, you know, people cooking the books. And we saw a little bit of that happen in last week in Washington on Thursday when Mr. Ryan in the House of Representatives called for a surprise voice vote on money to restore some Medicare funding. What it really did is it preserved Medicare reimbursement fee structure for physicians, the doc fix it was called. But he didn't want to go on the record to do that. And then they come up with some phony offset savings, which is that we're going to cut Medicare in 2024. In order to, you know, they're so afraid to say, hey, we need certain things, let's pay for it, and that's just common sense.
But then they don't seem to be hurt by some of these policies, although recently a fair number of Republicans have supported extending unemployment benefits because their constituents have been complaining.
Yeah. I mean, this the sort of, in a way, I sort of respect some of the people, like, we had various doctors, Dr. Ron Paul down where I live, who at least they have intellectual integrity. If you're for small government, then be for small government and say what you're going to cut and say, you know, we can't afford a global military and say what you're going to cut, rather than the folks who pretend to be conservative, push the wedge hot button social issues, but then they consistently support spending more than their tax policy produces in revenues, and they call themselves conservative. That's bad.
You're saying a true conservative is someone who would want to raise taxes simply to keep the budget balanced.
Yes, and at the same time, the true conservative would be willing to say, hey, if we're going to have this level of taxation and this is all that we have, let's cut the budget all the way down to the level of taxes. Let's cut Medicare by 40%, or do what Ron, you know, Ron Paul says, we ought to cut the Pentagon budget. And everybody ostracized him for that. Well, the reason he does it is because he wants to shrink the size of government, and he's honest about it.
Wendy Davis is running for governor now. Do you have any thoughts about running for elective office in the near future?
Oh, you know, I like my life just as it is, and I'm blessed to do public service from time to time. I hope she does well.
Bill White is a senior advisor for Lazard, a firm advising corporate leaders and governments worldwide. His book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.